Guten Morgen. Wir sind noch in unserer Sektion Kubla Applied, die Anwendung von Kubla. Wie macht man das? Wofür macht man das? Ob das geht und was es bringt und was wir uns davon erwarten. Und möchte Itai Sapir vorstellen. Ich freue mich, Itai hier vorzustellen. Itai Sapir hat Geschichte studiert in Tel Aviv zunächst und dann promoviert in Kunstgeschichte und Ästhetik an der Amsterdam School for Cultural Analysis und an der École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, also in Paris und in Amsterdam. Und zwar zum Thema Ténèbres sans leçon, The Aesthetics and Epistemology of Roman Tenebrist Painting, 1595-1610. Und in diesem Zusammenhang hat er mehrere Aufsätze verfasst, zu Caravaggio, zu Adam Elsheimer, theoretische auch. Jetzt ist er Postdoctoral Fellow in Florenz am Kunsthistorischen Institut mit einem Projekt zu den Hafenszenen von Claude Lorrain. Und um diese wird es jetzt auch gehen, Itai.
Dankeschön, Philipp, für die Einführung und auch danke natürlich für die Organisatorinnen für die Einladung hier und für alle, die gekommen sind, auch Sonntagmorgen. In his painstakingly constructed taxonomy of arts and artists, George Kubler seems to have forgotten one important category, Kublerian artists. Artists whose work fits the analysis and innovations of Kubler in the shape of time, and whom we, art historians, can understand better if we use Kubler's tools. One type of artist who can be deemed Kublerian, for example, is the artist craftsman, the creator of things, someone whose work cannot be categorized according to the conventional genres and techniques of humanistic art history. The artist I will be discussing today, Claude Lorrain, cannot be further away from this type. During his long life, Claude practically created nothing but rectangular, flat easel paintings representing landscapes and some tiny human figures. These paintings are, of course, to some extent, things, but they are the least thing-like of all works of art we know, apart perhaps from 20th century conceptual works. They are the epitome of humanistic artworks, a perfect object for art historical attention long before Kubler tried to expand the discipline's ambitions. They have no use value whatsoever, hardly any concrete physical presence. They are descriptive rather than material, representations more than presences. Claude seems to gain very little from Kubler's opening up of the field of art history to a broader history of things. But as my presence here can lead you to understand, I do believe Kubler is an important theorist for the understanding of Lorrain. An obvious way to start is to look for the painter himself in Kubler's text. And indeed, here he is, on page 87, list of the edition I have, proudly sharing the zoological-sounding category of ruminative artists with Paul Cézanne. Claude is described as a slow-paced, patient painter who dedicated his life to one genre, discreetly working on its gradual improvement. This gives us a clue to another Kublerian theme, one that can justify my claim that Claude is, after all, a Kublerian painter. Synthetically speaking, Kubler's concise book is going in two principal directions and correspondingly offers us two important seminal ideas that make him the topic of conferences 50 years after the book's publication. One, then, is the expansion of art history to discuss all things. The other, a novel treatment of time and artistic evolution. The latter topic's most exciting idea is that the history of things can be re-narrated as the history of aesthetic problems and their solutions. The description of Claude devoting the 60 years of his adult life to the elaboration of a single theme, landscape, seems a case in point, although it appears in the taxonomy of artists rather than in the parts that Kubler dedicates to art as problem-solving. But some difficulties arise right away. First, Kubler states explicitly that series of problem-solving, in spite of their typical 60-year span, are rarely limited to the career of one artist. And indeed, Claude's landscape are only one stage in the evolution of the genre, even if we limit ourselves to, 17th century works. But then again, this is the result, a result of the ambiguity and vagueness Kubler practices when he talks about the history of art as a series of solutions to problems. The kind of problems this could implicate is left frustratingly unclear. Kubler's examples range from relatively specific formal traits, such as the Gothic rib vault, to very general themes and genres, for instance, still life painting, or even, and I quote, the wide roads of 17th century painting and architecture. In fact, Kubler's idea of the evolution of art can be narrated as a sequence of problem-solving inventions is highly useful for the interpretation of at least one component of Claude's oeuvre, the one that I chose as my research project, the painter's port scenes. These form a real series of variations on a theme, both varied and coherent. One may even describe ports as a Claudian obsession, and again, it's a word that Kubler uses. In correspondence to Kubler's description, Claude's harbors are both similar enough to consider them as a sequence and to be readily received and understood by their initial audience, and sufficiently different from one another so the tedium is avoided and the world of forms makes through them a constant progress. Claude painted at least 20 port scenes. The exact number is debatable, as many coastal scenes contain boats and bays, but not the spectacularly built harbors that have become one of the artist's trademarks. If we accept ports in this minimal sense only, they are particularly concentrated in the middle period of the painter's career, namely during the 1630s and especially the 1640s. There are, however, earlier and later examples, so that all in all, the sequence is more or less 60 years long, that magic number of Kubler. We can analyze Claude's ports as different solutions to the same problem, that is, to their representation of a harbor in painting. Indeed, many elements of the composition require difficult decisions and evolve during Claude's life in a recognizable pattern of early, mature, and late style. An even better way to approach the subject would be to prolong the sequence to some other port scenes, contemporaneous or slightly earlier, such as those by Paul Bril and by Claude's master, Agostino Tassi. A Kublerian reading will reveal that this sequence is meaningful and historically intriguing. Before we go on to sketch such a reading, another remark is in order. In the concrete specific sense, our sequence will consist of harbor scenes, and the problem that the artist set to solve will be the representation of a seaport. But Kubler's ambiguous definition of problem leaves us some leeway to generalize even more. Indeed, port scenes are not just a realistic depiction of places, especially in Claude's case, where almost no painting depicts an actual real port. They have obvious broader meanings. One important aspect of any port is its being a meeting point, an interface between the human and the natural, artifice and wilderness. It is the place where two different and incommensurable systems confront each other and interact. The seas in the Western tradition, the French historian Alain Corbin has demonstrated that for the early modern era, the locus of the unknown, the savage, the untamed. A port is the outpost of civilization facing the sea, where the untamed is partially disciplined and the wild is, as much as possible, domesticated. The incommensurability of harbor's two components becomes a problem when one is trying to represent a seaport in painting. The representational system that had been developed since the beginning of the Renaissance, with linear perspective as its star feature, is adequate for the depiction of finite, calculable portions of space. The sea, however, has no limits, no visible coordinates, no linear elements of any kind. The problem of seaport painting is thus only a specific case of the general artistic difficulty of mixed representation, where two mimetic systems coexist in one work. Hubert d'Amiche analyzed a similar Kublerian problem when he discussed depictions of clouds and their interaction with the rigid rules of Renaissance geometrical spaces. So perhaps we can be as undecided as Kubler himself and define our one single sequence in two concurrent ways. Narrowly, as the development of seaport painting around Claude Lorrain. more generally, as the series of solutions given to the conundrum of hybrid representations, where artists in the 17th century tried to depict contiguously elements that obey different and incompatible representational principles. Of course, the latter definition of the sequence allows us to integrate it in a broader and longer sequence of paintings, including perhaps the earlier cloud depictions and later hybrid images, even modernist ones. Kubler's concept of formal sequence is fortunately quite elastic and oscillates in itself between the specific and the more general. For time's sake, let us tackle today only the more limited category of port scenes. As I've said, the sequence whose undeniable hero is Claude can be said to begin with his Roman master, Agostino Tassi. As any starting point of a sequence, this one is somewhat arbitrary. Indeed, in the Northern European tradition, port scenes were common before the 17th century, and Claude was, of course, familiar with Northern examples, being himself a foreigner in Rome, like many of his predecessors. But the Kublerian formal sequence, the concise trajectory from Tassi via Brill to Claude's different career stages, will be more than enough both to demonstrate the utility of Kubler's ideas and to tell us something about the meanings of different ways to depict harbors. The infinite as a concrete ontological possibility emerged in Europe towards the end of the 16th century in the writings of Giordano Bruno. A few decades later, as we can see in Blaise Pascal's famous musings on man's lonely position in the midst of terrible, imponderable infinity, the idea was no longer a heretical folly. In the meantime, the sea already forced painters to confront the existence of something that has no visible limits, even if infinity as a cosmological principle was not yet fully admitted. Agostino Tassi, working in Rome in the four decades immediately following Bruno's execution there in 1600, chose to depict seaports and was thus directly confronted with the major pictorial problem of the representation of infinity. Worse still, the configuration of a port, as I mentioned before, required the co-presence of the maritime figure of the infinite with the strictly finite and well-defined contours of man-made architecture. Tassi's solution, perhaps typical to many second-order artists, was to bypass the problem. To be sure, Tassi's career was not monolithic and included more than one solution to our problem, but if we disregard nuances, Tassi's ports follow a single repeated pattern. The canvas is almost entirely filled with the imposing edifices of an imaginary port. The open sea is relegated to the side, or framed by the harbor's architecture, like here. Paradoxically dwarfed by its impressive dimension. So this, the immense sea is dwarfed by the impressive dimensions of the port. In other cases, the view towards the limitless sea is blocked by sizable vessels. Hence, Tassi leaves us very little to see of the sea, of the end of the horizon, that limitless fictitious limit of maritime views. In Tassi's ports, there is no real dialectical relationship between the two mismatched components that make up a harbor. In a spirit that one could describe as humanist triumphalism, the human swallows the non-human, subjects it completely to its supposed supremacy. Tassi's solution to the problem of representing the interface of two incommensurable spaces is simply not to represent it. These are seaports without the sea, or in any case, without the characteristics that makes the sea such an intriguing special entity. Paul Brill, like Claude the Northerner in Rome and his predecessor as an illustrious landscape and seascape painter, has chosen the opposite evasion maneuver with a very similar result. In Brill's marines, mostly from the second decade of the 17th century, we find seaports without a port, or more precisely, without the architectural, spectacularly artificial part of a port. To be sure, we do have some imposing boats with their system of sails providing a grid of lines through which to look at the sea behind them, a motif that anticipates Claude's inventions, but the balance here seems to swing to the other extreme, and the human confrontation with the sea remains once again hardly represented. The infinity of the sea is visible and is partly domesticated when hidden from our view by the vessels, so that a step in the formal sequence has been made, but it is not yet Claude's fully fledged dialectics from the 1640s. Obviously, Claude Lorrain himself did not immediately achieve his masterful synthesis, the one that will signal a temporary ending to the sequence, as it will be such a brilliant solution to the problem that launched the whole quest. He went through several experimental solutions during his early period before the magic formula was found and the sequence entered into its mature phase. An early example, by Claude then, is the view of the port of Genoa, today in the Louvre in Paris, a painting that Marcel Rotlisberger, the great Claude specialist, dates to 1634, but that the Louvre presents perhaps more accurately as even earlier, from the late 1620s. Here the view is from the sea towards the city. Our visual space is clearly defined, clearly delimited, and the whole composition is based on a real existing port. The artistic problem is again avoided, or in other words, it is given a solution that fails to innovate. The premises to the Kumblerian sequence are there, but it has not started seriously yet. It is in the 1630s that Claude really embarks on his formal sequence of ports, the, and I quote Kubler, historical network of gradually altered repetitions of the same trait. And where the pictorial problem of a seaport, the conjunction of two incompatible representational systems, is finally recognized, analyzed, and treated. As I cannot here discuss the tens of stops on the trajectory, let us look at some selected examples that will give us an idea of the general development of Claude's formal sequence of harbors. The fundamental artistic decision that launched the series is the inversion of the painter's point of view. From now on, the port is seen from the land towards the sea. This is highly important, as in this case, one cannot avoid the direct confrontation with the sea's limitless nature. To be sure, Tassi and Brill, in earlier phases of the same sequence, phases that we now can call preparatory, have used the viewpoint from the land outwards. But they made concomitant choices that prevented the sequence from really taking off, either closing the pictorial space, as in Tassi's case, or, as did Brill, eliminating the architectural component of the port. Claude, from now on, as in this Louvre harbor scene with the Capitol Hill from 1636, combines all the ingredients that will result in his innovative formula. The sea open all the way to the horizon, imposing spectacular edifices denoting the classical, and in the foreground, a stripe of bare ground locating the spectator's point of view in space and offering us a threshold to the painted world while creating an in-between place that is neither wild and infinite as the sea nor artificial and pompous as the edifices. As you can see, the synthesis at this stage is still imperfect. In fact, the infinity of the sea is only hinted at. It does not go much further than Tassi's claustrophobic compositions. Although the left-hand half of the picture is devoid of architecture and thus suggests a vertiginous opening, it is timorously separated from our view through the insertion of an elaborate, voluminous vessel. With the help of two further boats and the lighthouse, the whole horizon can be seen only through a geometric grid of straight and diagonal lines. It is, as it were, tamed and weighed to incline in front of our superb epistemological tools. Only 1 year later, in 1637, Claude takes the formal sequence one step further. In this seaport with the Villa Medici, appropriately conserved in the Uffizi in Florence, though inappropriately currently hidden from the public view, the opening of the composition is much more audacious. The general composition is quite similar to the former one, palaces on the right, ships on the left, sea in the middle, but this middle section has now been completely transformed. A significant space has been left empty, as it were. Infinity, or at least its most perfect figure in our sublunar world, the sea, is now being exposed without further inhibitions. Indeed, the horizon is shown contiguously with another figure of the unknowable immensity of nature, the sun. The combined effect of the solar blinding and the sea's limitlessness disorient the viewer and contrast dramatically with the pretentious, solid buildings flanking the shore. One would not be hard-pressed to find an anthropological interpretation to this contrast. The technological pretentiousness of Europe is somewhat ridiculed by the confrontation with the mighty elements of the natural world. The Prado port of Ostia with the embarkation of St. Paula from the late 1630s present an obvious change of format due to the nature of the Spanish Royal Commission, as well as other important, and I quote again, gradually altered repetitions of the same trait. The imposing edifices now line the port from both sides, symmetrically framing the opening to infinity. In the foreground is now a stone platform, emphasizing more than ever before the harsh conflict between the firm, clear-cut surfaces made by humans and the soft, hazy, liquid expanse of the sea. The representation of architecture is following the strict rules of linear perspective, but its converging lines come together in the underdetermined area where the water and light irremediably blur our view. It is as if our eyes were gently led through curves and diagonals straight to their perdition in a place they cannot make sense of. Another important novelty of the Prado work is the inclusion of narrative content, whereas previous ports contained just genre scenes. This is not a formal element per se, but it did become a permanent feature of later harbor depictions, including the great 1640s compositions that are, in a way, the pinnacle of the whole series. Of these five or six works, a typical example is the London seaport with the embarkation of the Queen of Sheba. This famous 1648 painting is again in a horizontal format, but it presents a masterful reworking of the innovations we pointed out in the Prado composition from a decade earlier. The intricate network of interpenetrating natural and artificial elements is here enhanced. One can finally talk about a real dialectical composition, where none of the two elements swallows the other, and in which their subtly rhythmical interaction and contrast is the very subject of the painting. The composition is clearly divided into a main man-made realm in which linear perspective is an ultimate rigid authority. This domain is situated on the right-hand half and on the left-hand quarter of the painting's width, and in the middle, the open expanse of the sea. There, it is not geometry that structures the image, it has no validity in the maritime realm, but the rising, hypnotizing sun. It has already been observed that Claude thus creates two competing centers for his compositions. But the two realms are far from being completely separated, and this is where one can speak about dialectics. After all, Kubler reminds us, the works of art are always intrinsically complicated. The bridge leading to the tower on the right is perhaps the focal point of this complexity, otherwise present everywhere on the canvas, but to which I cannot do full justice here. The bridge is an agent of the solid sent into the heart of the liquid matter. It is, just like the port itself, an example of human artifice and perspicacity in dealing with elements that cannot be easily tamed. But obviously, the efficiency of such astuteness is limited. Nature flourishes unrestrained in the trees just above the bridge, and, with irony usually unsuspected of Claude, reappears on the bridge itself, albeit in the domesticated, tidy form of pot plants. And the play goes on and on, with the geometrical but natural shells in the foreground, with the weeds invading the fissures in the architectural stone, with the men in the foreground trying to look at and make sense of the sun, and so on. Again, there is much to say about the anthropological implications of such a structure, about its meaning as more than commentary on a hubris-ridden society at the age of territorial expansion and scientific revolution. But let us not leave our main point out of sight. If indeed that is what the painting is about, the whole series of seaports becomes a meditation on such anthropological questions. And this specific work's formal properties are only a particularly convincing, complex, and efficient pictorial treatment of that subject. And then again, and in an even more Kublerian mode, perhaps the theme of the painting is time. Perhaps Claude's seaports are, after all, presenting us with the shape of time. We will shortly discuss this hypothesis more generally, but what one cannot oversee here is the contrast between bright new buildings on one side of the harbor and crumbling ruins on the other side, both groups of clearly classical style in a depiction of a pre-classical Old Testament scene. If we continue following the formal sequence of Claude Seaport, we arrive at a much later example, the depiction of a harbor from 1674, nowadays at the Alte Pinakothek in Munich. It is barely a port, in fact, and thus only just qualifies for a sequence. But it does represent some boats, classical architecture flanking the sea, two towers, and an opening. It is a much simplified version of earlier seaports. This minimalistic treatment can be interpreted as the final step of the sequence. Claude gave up narrative content and anecdotal detail to concentrate on what really interested him, on his quintessential artistic problem, the contiguous depiction of man-made geometrical objects and the open sea, here more boundless than ever before. The painter has finally arrived at a pure, concise solution to the pictorial problem, in the Kublerian sense, that has accompanied him all along his creative life. Unfortunately, this promising theory suffers from a serious setback. The Munich painting is in fact an almost identical copy, made by Claude himself, of a much earlier work, today at the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. The earlier work, the prime object to follow Kubler, dates from 1634. The second one, the replica, from exactly 40 years later. It cannot be simply described as the last accomplished step of the sequence, but neither can it be considered an early stage, immature and still searching, because 40 years later, Claude thought it appropriate to copy it without changing almost anything. This brings us to the brief last section of my paper that one may call, just like Kubler's last chapter, some kinds of duration. It is significant that following his discussion of formal sequences and of the ways in which the latter help us narrate the history of things, Kubler tackles the issue of time and its heterogeneity. Time does not always pass at the same rhythm, nor, historically speaking, is it a one-way arrow that eternally progresses in the same direction. These truisms are particularly applicable to Claude's case. Claude Seaport depictions construct a dialectical tension between two sorts of space, but at the same time, they hint at complex rapports between notions of temporal significance, infinity and determinacy, history and mythology, past and present, the knowable and the ineffable. All these pairs are anchored in a multidimensional temporal network to which one can add, as we've just seen with the Munich painting, the complex temporality of Claude's own process of creation, creating, copying, remaking, modifying, removing, not to mention the frequent phenomenon of synchronic pendants, a corporate work of art in Kubler's words. Claude's Harbor sequence is thus doubly engaged with the exploration of time. On the one hand, it presents, especially in the narrative works, history at its full complexity. Departures and arrivals, pregnant moments in time, are here juxtaposed with intricate networks of visual temporal hints. Architecture from different periods and in different states of conservation and degradation, historical and contemporary clothing and technology, the eternal repetitive tempo of the waves. Thematically, seaports are here seen in the role as the motor of history, where cultural exchange, intercontinental mobility, and the progress of knowledge all have their source. On the other hand, the sequence itself demonstrates a case of time's complex shapes. Formal sequences, we are reminded, are never a simple unidirectional affair. A pictorial problem launches the series. Solutions are then proposed, rejected, better ones invented, but the order of things is closer to a helter-skelter than to a highway. This is perhaps the limit of Kubler's insertion of the history of art in a general history of things. Whereas the latter can often be linear and straightforward, our discipline has to deal with capricious and volatile objects. It makes one think of the state of art historical knowledge 50 years after the shape of time. Our challenge of constructing rigorous, clear-cut formal sequences out of the chaotic flood of forms is somewhat analogous to the aporia of Claude's seaports, a heroic but ultimately hopeless attempt to build solid, resistant edifices that would ideally make some sense out of the formless, endless, ruthless sea. Thank you.